You're listening to Split Wheel, the Chicago Independent Radio Project show on popular culture and societal attitudes. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and I'll be examining how film, television, and other elements of mass media both shape and reflect how we think about the world. For more information or archive shows, visit kevinfulham.net. Good morning, and welcome to another edition of Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. Joining me once again as my guest is Kendall Phillips, who is a professor in the Department of Communication and Rhetorical Studies at Syracuse University. He was on a few years ago to talk about his book Projected Fears, and he has recently written another book called Dark Directions, Romero, Craven, Carpenter, and the Modern Horror Film, covering the three iconic horror directors, George A. Romero, Wes Craven, and John Carpenter. And good morning, Kendall.
Good morning, Kevin. Hey, thanks for having me back on.
Hey, yeah, thank you for being here. And so we're going to be talking about what you call the second golden age of horror. We'll get to that in a little bit, certainly with regards to these three iconic directors and how their films sort of played into the cultural zeitgeist in America at that particular time. So what are we talking about when you talk about the golden ages of horror?
Well, horror is one of those genres that's always around, and we can actually trace horror all the way back into the 1890s when films first started. So you find the images consistently. It's a very popular genre. But I do think there were two periods in American film history where not only was the genre very popular, but it also made really dramatic innovations in how it was presented and the nature of the genre. And so the first of those was starting in 1931 with really the first films called horror films, and that was Dracula and Frankenstein, the sort of classic Universal Pictures. And that started that whole era of the classic kind of gothic monsters. And then that kept getting played out, and there were different iterations, the science fiction films and the slasher films and et cetera, et cetera. But it seemed to me that the next really dramatic period of change and innovation and productivity, what I would call the second golden age of horror, is a period running roughly from 1968 until 1982, and that's the period where you see a lot of the films that are still iconic today, films like Halloween and Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. That's really the period, I think, is the next big innovative period, and so that's why I call it the second golden age.
And in the beginning of your book, you talk about how there's so much going on politically, in 1968. You've got the Vietnam War is in full swing. You've got the 68 presidential election. You saw the assassination of Robert Kennedy. And you had the riots in Chicago around the Democratic National Convention that year. You had riots in France that year. Mexico City Olympics with the Black Power salute. There was a lot going on politically, not just in America, but all over the world.
I think 1968 is such a powerful historical turning point, not only for America, but for the world. And in some ways, if you think about 1967 as kind of the summer of love and all the peaceful flower power and the sense that, with the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement, that there was almost a sense that the world really was going to change and war would stop and things would get better. And then all that seemed to crumble in 68. It was like a giant negative backlash. And so I think the filmmakers of that time, in part, picked up on that kind of disillusionment, that cynicism, almost nihilism, and that infects an enormous amount of the horror films from that period.
And I think that's also around the time when the Hays Code was disbanded in cinema.
There were some really major. The other part of this that is maybe not as easily seen by casual students of history is that there were enormous number of changes in the studio system. Part of which was the ending. So governmental censorship really started falling apart after the Supreme Court decision in 1952, which was really the first time films were seen as part of the First Amendment. So between 52 and the 60s, this was a period where state boards of censorship were being shut down, and slowly the government was getting out of the job of censoring films. Then the other part was the Hays Code or the Production Code. That really lasted kind of until about 1966. It was losing power. Starting in 1966, it all but completely failed. And so by 1968, the Production Code was completely replaced by the rating system. In the middle of all of that was the dismantling of the studio system, the system that in the 20s, 30s, and 40s had really been the main center of all American filmmaking. Starting in the 50s and certainly by the end of the 60s, those studios were fragmenting. And what that meant was the studios weren't so much in control, but increasingly independent directors or even screenwriters, they were able to create films outside the studio system. And that's where you see a lot of the innovative horror work coming.
I'm talking to Kendall Phillips, who is the author of the book Dark Directions, Romero, Craven, Carpenter, and the Modern Horror Film, talking about George A. Romero, Wes Craven, and John Carpenter. And you mentioned the rise of independent cinema. These are all directors who got their starts in either the late 60s or 70s, making very, very low-budget movies. And I mean, we're talking about, I think Halloween was made for a few hundred thousand dollars. Certainly the zombie movies, Romero zombie movies, were made on the cheap. You mentioned Tobe Hooper making Texas Chainsaw Massacre in the early 70s for a pittance compared to today's films. You also talk about how Romero, Craven, and Carpenter, they were never given the status of the auteurs of their day, presumably due to the fact that these guys were involved in the horror genre of cinema. Why is it that horror has never received that sort of respect that mainstream film in terms of comedy and drama has?
Yeah, it's funny. It is amazing. Of the directors of the 60s and 70s, these guys, the horror guys, get completely ignored. And you're absolutely right. The horror genre in general has always been seen as kind of the dark little secret of cinema. I think part of the reason for that is that horror is a little bit like pornography and slapstick comedy, in that they're very much about bodies, not only watching bodies on the screen, whether they be bodies killed or bodies slipping on a banana peel, or in pornography, bodies doing all kinds of other things, but they're also about our kind of bodily reaction. These are movies that make you scream or laugh out loud, so they really draw a kind of physical response more than a cerebral response. And so if you compare the films of Romero to, say, Stanley Kubrick, Kubrick's films are very much focused on the kind of esoteric, the cerebral. But Romero or Craven, they're very smart films, but they're really focused on the kind of bodily reaction of the audience as well as the bodies on the screen. And our culture has just always seen the body as low culture and the brain as high culture. And I think horror is always trapped in that kind of divide.
Yeah, and you did have Stanley Kubrick make a film like The Shining. And sort of, he's not considered to be a quote-unquote horror director, but it's interesting because that film received a great amount of critical praise, and I mean, that was seen in a sense as something akin to high art. If you go back and say, look at Academy Awards, you've got Silence of the Lambs that won Best Picture in 91, you've also got The Exorcist that won a Best Picture nomination back in the early 70s, Silence of the Lambs made by Jonathan Demme, and Exorcist by William Friedkin. The Exorcist actually is considered probably, certainly it's right in that second golden age of horror. But how do you sort of contrast those kinds of films in terms of the attention that they got with the horror films coming from Romero, Craven, and Carpenter?
Well, I think there are two distinctions. One is, often what happens are these well-established auteurs. And Kubrick was certainly very well established by The Shining, which is 1980. So this was kind of, in some ways, near the kind of edge of his career. I mean, that was really the point where he was the most famous, was in the 70s, and 1980, The Shining. And then if you look at Friedkin, he had already won an Academy Award for The French Connection. And it's like the auteurs who establish themselves as smart and outside the genre can dabble in horror, and then it's respectable. But people who stay and work consistently in the genre, the director gets erased by the attention to the genre. So no one thinks about Romero, Craven, or Carpenter. They think about horror films, and then Craven and Carpenter become subsets of the horror film. So the genre kind of erases them, even though, arguably, they're doing just as smart work as someone like Kubrick or Demme, and doing it more consistently, which ought to be laudable, but often is not.
One of the things I was also thinking about is the nature of the acting talent that is drawn to those different kinds of films. The Shining had Jack Nicholson. Silence of the Lambs, obviously, you've got Jodie Foster, you've got Anthony Hopkins. And typically, the movies made by Carpenter or by Wes Craven, you don't have sort of that A-list Hollywood talent.
No, you're absolutely right. The budgets are completely different. And I think as well, in many of those films, the tone is different. I mean, Kubrick's The Shining is a different kind of film, so we'll set that aside. But if you look at both The Exorcist and The Silence of the Lambs, they are kind of mainstream films, even though they're horror films, and certainly with The Exorcist, there are a lot of transgressive elements in it. I mean, it's very graphic, and it's very vile and profane. But it is ultimately a film that reinforces sort of broad cultural ideas. Folks like Romero, Craven, Carpenter are so outside of that that you're right, they're dealing with very low budgets, often very poor acting, and in some ways often more transgressive ideas. So they're really pushing the envelope more than the mainstream studios can do, and that's what makes it interesting. It's almost like they have better ideas, but the better the idea, the less people are willing to put money behind it.
Yeah. And well, Carpenter is an interesting case. I want to talk about that in a little bit, because he seemed to step more outside the boundaries of traditional horror in the 80s, certainly. Yeah, films like Starman, and you know, he had a number of action movies that he also put on as well, too. But do horror directors, do they get pigeonholed? I mean, even, you know, with regards to young horror directors today, is it the kind of case where, for most people, if you start in that genre, is that where you tend to stay, I guess?
I think the problem is if you succeed in that genre, you definitely get pigeonholed. There are a number of sort of more mainstream directors, and an example that pops to mind is Francis Ford Coppola, whose first film was a sort of low-budget horror film. And a lot of people who started with Roger Corman. Roger Corman got a lot of directors started making cheap, often exploitation horror or biker films. As long as that wasn't successful, they got their chops. They were able to go on and do the films they wanted to do. The people like Romero, whose first film, Night of the Living Dead, was his kind of signature film, or John Carpenter, whose really third film, Halloween, became his signature film. Once you have success in the genre, you become known for the genre. And if you look at either Carpenter's efforts through, like, Starman, or Wes Craven had the film Music of the Heart, which was the biopic about the music teacher with Meryl Streep, a lovely film, was not successful. And I think in part it was not successful because people don't go see a Wes Craven film to watch an inspirational film about violence.
Well, it's interesting because all the directors that you featured in the book, Romero, Craven, and Carpenter, you know, they have a sort of the prestige attached to the name, where the name precedes the film. You know, it's you know, John Carpenter's, you know, X, or, you know, Wes Craven's New Nightmare or whatever. And so no one's going to see Wes Craven's Music Story or whatever.
Right.
But that's a pretty amazing, I think, tribute to a director that you can put their name on the film and that will mean tickets sold.
It is. In fact, the only example I can think of, really, of a director who was very prominent in horror but able to get out and become somewhat more mainstream was David Cronenberg, who was through the film A History of Violence, and then I think Eastern Promise was the other film, and then the more recent work, has sort of slowly become a more mainstream director, still kind of on the edge and a little very independent and very different than most filmmakers. But Cronenberg is one of the few who was able to escape that early horror genre and now make films that people don't associate with the genre. That's interesting.
So let's talk a little bit about each respective director and the prominent theme running through their work. And so you talk about the body with Romero, and why don't you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, I think, I mean, all horror is about the body. So in some ways, saying horror movies about the body is a pretty easy thing to say. But what I noticed in looking through all of the films of George Romero, not just the zombie films or the Living Dead films, but across almost every film he's made, the body operates in a kind of interesting way, in which the body is often the point of tension between desire and civilized repression. So The Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, those are pretty easy to see that. You watch that and the zombies are clearly the contrast to civilization. And in fact, the appearance of these ghouls or the living dead is what threatens and ultimately unsettles civilized norms. And so, in fact, if you look through the Living Dead films, you see the kind of escalation of that critique. Night of the Living Dead clearly has a lot of overtones about race, but also has a lot of overtones about the generational tension of the 1960s with the young people and the old people struggling over who will be in charge, all the while the zombies outside are putting pressure, ultimately overwhelming them. Then if you just, this is a quick example, if you take a Dawn of the Dead, very much about 70s culture, very much about consumerism, very much about the malaise of living in a prosperous society but without morals or values or any direction. And you can sort of trace that through. But let me give you another example that's not one of the Living Dead films that I think illustrates some of the ways that Romero works. And that's one of his collaborations with Stephen King, the adaptation of the film The Dark Half. In The Dark Half, it tells the story of a writer who's a very literary, high-culture writer, but who's made most of his money under a pseudonym writing kind of graphic, violent crime novels. And ultimately, he decides that he wants to get rid of that crime novelist pseudonym, and so he has a burial for him, and he decides he's going to leave that Dark Half behind and move on with a kind of nicer, more literary, cultured life. In the film, The Dark Half, that pseudonym, comes to life and pursues him. And so you really have the physical body of the writer torn between the two desires, one to be cultured and civilized and respected, and the other full of all the graphic desires for violence and sex and control. And for Romero, all that intersects at the physical body. And that's why so many of his films are about graphic disintegration and falling apart and oozing and abject bodies. And I think that's what makes Romero's films interesting. I think that's kind of his directorial signature.
It seems like a kind of a modern-day Jekyll and Hyde story, The Dark Half.
Very much so. And I think a lot of Romero's films borrow from that idea of the Jekyll and Hyde, that kind of contrast between these two different desires, either in the body of one person. I'll give you another quick example. He had a film much more recently, around 2000-2001, called Bruiser. This is an independent film shot in outside the U.S., probably not as known to most people. But the plot of it's fairly simple. An everyday working guy who's kind of put upon by his wife and his boss and treated badly, he's kind of a doormat. One day, after suffering so many indignities, he wakes up and his face is gone. It's just a white mask, but it's his flesh. It's not a mask. It's literally his face is turned into a blank white mask. And the only way he can find to escape this nameless blank face is to kill the people who have been oppressing him. And in the end, he kills his boss, who's been a completely obnoxious guy the whole time and very rude and condescending to him. When he kills the boss, his face returns. And so once again, for Romero, that tension between desire and repression is physically marked on the body of the character.
Yeah, I think you also mentioned briefly in the book a movie like Falling Down that came out in the 90s with Michael Douglas that obviously it wasn't a Romero film, but mainstream movie that also dealt with, you know, this, you know, oppressed guy who he just sort of snaps. You know, for people who you know, look at superhero stories, that's basically the story of the Incredible Hulk. You know, that whenever he gets angry and stressed, that he turns into this monster, and you see this physical manifestation of it.
Yeah, I would love to have Romero do Avengers 2. Yeah. We should recommend that to the studio, saying. But no, I think exactly right. And that's a long-standing literary motif, you're right, in plays like The Hulk or Jekyll and Hyde. But I think when you watch the films of Romero, if you really pay attention the way he uses the physical body of the characters, you'll find that he does it in a way a little unique that really becomes kind of his signature across the film.
Let's talk a little bit about Wes Craven and how you view his the gothic style, I guess, of his cinema.
Yeah, I think Wes Craven, you know, again, borrows from a literary tradition that precedes him. But he's very much a filmmaker about the gothic. And the most obvious example that everyone will immediately understand is A Nightmare on Elm Street, which is your, you know, purest example of old-school gothic. There was a crime in the past that was covered up. It's been buried, but it returns. And it doesn't return during the daylight. It returns at night in this kind of supernatural way. And much of the film is spent with people saying, is this really happening or are these people crazy? And that's a literary tradition of the Gothic that goes all the way back to the 18th century. So you can find almost exactly the same motif appearing in all kinds of films novels about, you know, am I crazy or is that really a ghost? Am I insane or is this showing me some vision of a past crime that needs to be uncovered? And so Nightmare on Elm Street sort of follows through that. What I find is that that's not the only film where Craven uses that idea, nor is it always about the supernatural. So let's take an earlier film. If I look at a film like The Hills Have Eyes, it's very much about the exact same tension point, the point between the civilized world we believe is rational and right and the knowledge or the fear that outside in the shadows or at night there is another world, an uncivilized, savage world of unnatural entities and dangerous things, and that we're afraid that that world will overwhelm our world. So if you think about The Hills Have Eyes, it's about a family on vacation, perfectly normal 70s family in their Winnebago, and they're driving, and the father decides to take a shortcut, always a bad idea in a horror movie, and ends up with the car breaking down in the middle of this abandoned desert, which was a military field. And as the night creeps in, they find out that there's another savage, sort of primitive family who lives in the, in this area, and the conflict begins between the civilized family and the savage wilderness kind of clan living out in the woods. And it really is that tension between civilization and savagery. And I think you can find that in any number of Craven's films.
I think that's also a theme that you have, that you talk about with Carpenter's films as well, too, with The Frontier. We talk about civilization and savagery. Is that also what you're getting at?
Very much so. And here's a good way, and that's actually a wonderful question to show what I think, at least, is the subtle distinction between the directors. Each of these directors, Romero, Craven, and Carpenter, find a tension point. And I think in the introduction I argue that that's the location of horror. For Romero, the location of horror is between civilization and desire, and it's located in the body. For Carpenter, it's a similar tension, but again, between civilization and savage desire or savagery. But for Carpenter, it's about geography. Carpenter's films consistently focus on the space. And so that's why so many of John Carpenter's films are about people who are isolated. So you think about a very early film, Assault on Precinct 13, in the middle of Los Angeles, and yet we have this kind of abandoned police station. No one comes to it. The communications are cut off, and through a series of unfortunate events, the people inside are surrounded by this angry gang who are bent on killing everybody inside the station. And so very much like a Western, here you have a kind of an outpost. Even though it's in the middle of Los Angeles, it's a kind of isolated outpost. Very much the same thing in a film like The Thing, which most people will probably know, is set in the North Pole, and these researchers are alone, and an alien comes, and again, they're out there on their own. Same thing for a film like The Fog, which is, again, a film set on the coast where a supernatural fog comes in to threaten the inhabitants, and again, they're out there on the edge. And so it's always about this kind of frontier experience of being right on the edge, where civilization is starting to fail and the savage things on the other side of civilization are starting to creep back in.
Well, how does this play in to, when you talk about the second golden age of horror, to what's going on politically in America at that particular time? You know, certainly 1970s, urban dystopia was a huge theme, I think, running not only through film, but through life with New York City and becoming this sort of cesspool of crime. And you had Carpenter's Escape from New York that came out in 81 that pretty much, they depicted crime as being so bad in America that they just decided to turn Manhattan into a prison. How about, not only with Carpenter, but with the other directors, where did you see sort of that link between themes in their films and cultural anxiety?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The whole period was one of much greater cynicism and pessimism. It was very much an era where people believed that the American dream had started to fade. It was failing. The economy was in trouble. The war in Vietnam, of course, had gone horribly badly. It was America's first real geopolitical loss. And Watergate. And so you think all of the foundational institutions, the family, the government, the military, the president, the economy, all those were failing. And so people were pretty angry and pretty pessimistic, and so then you get that tone, and sometimes in very direct ways. So, as I said, if you look at a film like Night of the Living Dead, which I think is the film that began this whole era, it is all about the institutions of society systematically failing all the way to the point at the really powerful and poignant ending of Night of the Living Dead. Now, this is a spoiler alert. If you haven't seen it, you should go see it and not listen to the rest of this. At the end of the film, after having survived all of this onslaught and bickering, our protagonist, this African-American male named Ben, he hears a rescue party. He hears the gunshots. He thinks, oh, finally, I've survived the Night of the Living Dead. I will escape. I will have survived. He comes to the window to look for his rescuers. The rescuers see this shape in the window, assume it's a zombie, and unceremoniously and abruptly shoot him in the head. And then his body is drug out and thrown onto a funeral pyre with all the ghouls he was trying to fight off, and he's burned. Now, that's a film that does not make sense in America today, which is a somewhat more optimistic place. But in 1968, with all of the institutions of society failing and this overwhelming sense of pessimism, that ending made perfect sense.
You touch on something very interesting in the book when you talk about the close of the second golden age of horror being 1982 and specifically John Carpenter's The Thing and the very different reaction that that movie received compared to E.T. the Extraterrestrial coming out at that particular time as well that probably outgrossed it by a factor of, 100 to 1.
If not more.
And The Thing is it was actually a remake of the 1950s film that was remade, I guess, last year. I did not see the latest remake. But in John Carpenter's The Thing, you have Kurt Russell and Wilford Brimley leading a bunch of scientists at the North Pole. And there is an alien ship that crash lands and has the ability to mimic its prey. So it turned into this whole game of the enemy among us. One of us is not human, and he's killing the rest of us, but we're not exactly sure who that is. So you have the suspicion and paranoia ratcheted up. And an excellent film. I didn't catch it until many years after it came out. And apparently critically not that well received at the time, but in hindsight has come to be appreciated as an excellent film.
I think The Thing is a perfect example of this idea of the second golden age. There was a period for roughly 14 years where all what you said is exactly what made sense to moviegoers. Pessimism, paranoia, a sense that things were not going to get better, institutions would fail. And The Thing is almost a perfect synthesis of all of those themes from before and with some major studio backing. It has very good effects. It looks very professional. The actors are very, very good. Kurt Russell does a great job. Wilford Brimley, the others. There's not a bunch of ham-handed amateur actors. And in fact, the studio felt that The Thing would be their big box office film. But the country's mood had changed. Reagan was elected in 1980 on the promise of returning America to its glory, a new dawn for the country, increasing optimism, increasing belief in our strength, that our strength would make us right. And so if you look at the heroes of the 1980s, they were heroes like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone. And if you look at the films that were prominent, they were almost all optimistic films. And so the summer of 1982, 30 years since the summer of 1982, and that was one of those sort of big watershed summer moments with lots of great films, including E.T., and almost all of the other films from 1982 were basically optimistic films. They were films that saw a future for America. The Thing is the one that just had a very different tone. And so filmmakers of film audiences at the time said, that doesn't make sense to us. It seems old, it seems mean, it seems brutal, and so they decided to turn against it. And that really was in some ways the end of John Carpenter's dramatic rise. And the beginning of his somewhat less dramatic post-career.
He does went to doing Starman a couple years later, Big Trouble in Little China. It's interesting you talk about sort of a change in the more optimistic tilt of the country. Even a franchise like Rambo, First Blood, the first Rambo movie, very dark movie, very sad story about this disaffected Vietnam vet. And then later he turns into this American hero later throughout the decade and sort of becomes this icon of American power. The interesting thing, though, is that you talk about The Thing being sort of the close of that age of horror. When you talk about Wes Craven, certainly he had a start in the 70s, Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes and very dark films, though he has his biggest success with a movie like Nightmare on Elm Street that came out in 1984. Is that sort of like the one exception to that sort of theory? Or how do you view that within the constraints of American politics at that particular time?
I don't think so. And in some ways, I think what's interesting about Craven is that he is the most malleable of the directors in terms of both style and tone and content of his work. So if you were to sit down and watch, let's pick Craven's first film, which really fits in the era, Last House on the Left. And some people may have seen the film, some people may have heard of the remake. It's a fairly simple story. A family's daughter goes off to the city to see a concert. She ends up being abducted by a very vicious group of criminals. They torture, rape, kill her and her friend in really, really unpleasant very claustrophobic, very close, unpleasant ways. Then their car breaks down, and so the killers have to seek refuge in the house of the young girl's family through a series of kind of unlikely coincidences. Eventually, the mother and father realize that these people have killed their daughter, and they proceed to have a long process of revenge killing the killers. And so the film ends with the parents having killed the people who killed their daughter. And it's a very bloody film. It's a very graphic and unpleasant film. That very much feels like Texas Chainsaw. It very much feels like Night of the Living Dead. It feels almost nothing like, just in terms of the tone of the film, Nightmare on Elm Street, which, while violent, is not anywhere near as gritty and cynical. And so I think partly because Craven works in that land between illusion and reality, his style has a lot more flexibility of moving to change to the tone. And so for that matter, if you were to sit down and watch Last House on the Left, and then watch Nightmare on Elm Street, and then watch Scream, while you can identify some very similar patterns, which is what I try to do in the book, I think you'd be struck by how different in tone, style, and cinematography those three films look.
Is it often the case where horror that's grounded in reality seems more menacing than that which isn't?
I don't think so, because you can certainly have supernatural films like The Exorcist that feel very gritty. Films decide how much distance we have from the action. So you think about violence. Like, violence is a perpetual part of American film. There are films in which I can watch violence and it's pleasant and it's satisfying when the bad guy is shot or. And I think part of that is our amount of distance from it. So we sort of see it as something far off and it's a spectacle and we can enjoy it and watch it. Films like Last House on the Left or Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Night of the Living Dead are films where, through a variety of cinematic techniques, including the length of shots and the focus and the distance, don't give us distance. We feel like we're there watching this very violent act. We see their reactions to it. We see the degradation. And so, you know, personally, Last House on the Left, of all the films from this book, that was the toughest one for me to watch over and over again. I had to do the work of the book. But it was the one that afterwards I always wanted to take a shower. It was just really uncomfortable being in this, not only sadistic sexual violence, but with almost no distance, feeling like it was happening right in front of you because of the way the camera makes it so close. And that's part of the thing that's very different about violence in those films versus, say, you know, a Rambo sequel or an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, where it's almost cartoonishly distant violence from us.
Yeah, I'm thinking of also, you know, The A-Team, unbelievably popular TV show in the mid-80s where you've got, you know, 1,000 bullets fired every episode and no one gets hurt. You know, it's
amazing.
Yeah.
They were the worst shots ever, weren't they? I mean,
maybe a tire would get blown out occasionally. You know, I think that was pretty much it. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm talking with Kendall Phillips, who is a professor in the Department of Communication and Rhetorical Studies at Syracuse University. We're talking about his new book called Dark Directions, all about Romero, Craven, Carpenter, and the modern horror film, and discussing the three iconic horror directors, George A. Romero, Wes Craven, and John Carpenter. And one of the things I want to talk to you about is Halloween, classic John Carpenter film from the late 70s with the notorious Michael Myers, the serial killer, featuring young Jamie Lee Curtis. And it's a movie that's been dissected over and over again in terms of looking at that film as social commentary. Certainly people have used that film as the basis for the Final Girl horror theory, you know, talking about how there's a number of horror films that sort of follow this similar pattern. And it's interesting that John Carpenter has repeatedly said that he never intended Halloween to have any sort of social message or for it to be a morality play. That's come up again because Jamie Lee Curtis is the one that survives and she is the one that's most pure, most virgin. It's a question that I sometimes have involving academia, in that movies that are so popular are dissected endlessly and that maybe people are reading into messages that weren't intentional. What do you think about that in regards to Halloween and horror in general?
I think at one level, I do not assume that the director has the final word on what their films mean. And I don't mean that as any disrespect to John Carpenter or anybody else. But you think about it. So for just an easy example, the plays of William Shakespeare were in no way designed to be part of high culture. At the time of their production, they were the lowest of low culture. People threw oranges. That's why there's so many fight scenes in Shakespeare. It was, you know, just low culture. It was only much later that people began to recognize that those plays not only captured a moment in English history, but captured aspects of English culture and language. And that's when people began to appreciate what those plays were really about. But I have no sense that William Shakespeare had aspirations for, you know, Romeo and Juliet to be taught to every sophomore in the history of the world. It was more just a moment, capturing a moment in time. And so I think John Carpenter and in some ways George Romero and others, whether they were intentional or not, they were piecing together stories out of the cultural landscape of their moment. So John Carpenter is making Halloween in the midst of all those things happening in 1978. The women's rights movement, tensions about morality, the rise of the moral majority, questions about the family, and whether he was intentionally sitting down and saying, I'm going to critique American culture, as he would do in the film They Live, which he has even said was really his diatribe against the Reagan administration. It's still, in writing at that moment, he is reflecting that cultural dimensions of where he was. And so as my job as a critic or historian looking at the rhetoric of these films is to look at where the film illuminates something about that cultural moment in time. And so in some ways, his job is to be a writer. My job is to be a reader. He doesn't tell me what to do. I don't tell him what to do. We both do our jobs quite well separately.
That's a very apt analogy with Shakespeare, by the way. You know, we talked about Reagan's impact a little bit in terms of the end of a second golden age of horror with this this sort of turn towards a more optimistic America. You talk a little bit in your book near the end about similarities between post-68 America and post-9/11 environments. And you want to discuss that a little bit.
I think America post-9/11 was in a very similar state to where we were in post-68. We were uncertain. We were rattled. We were rattled in some very disturbing ways. And what I find interesting, and it's somewhat similar to the 68 period, is that the horror films that arose out of that trauma and uncertainty that we all experienced was often very angry horror. So perhaps the most dramatic rise in that post-9/11 era was the rise of what people now call torture porn. So films like Saw, and in some ways I think an even more ideal example is Hostel. And what I find fascinating about those films is that the central question for both Saw and Hostel and any number of that genre of horror, the central question is, how far would you go to survive? Right. So in Saw, it is, are you willing to stick your hand through shards of glass to find a key that removes the thing that's going to cut your head off? In Hostel, it's ultimately about how savage and violent will this young man get to escape this torture situation. And that's very much what we were asking ourselves as a country after 9/11. How far would we go in war? How far would we go in giving up our civil rights? How far would we go on surveillance of our own citizens? How far would we go about suspending constitutional and legal rights for people to protect ourselves from this thing that we were afraid of? And I think there are lots of other more subtle messages going on in post-9/11 films, but that really struck me as a very clear example of horror as a response to cultural trauma.
One of the things that I think might be different between the two environments is you talk about the frontier, certainly with John Carpenter's films, and how that's sort of a continuation of the Western. And it seems that, you know, in terms of the urban dystopias that we saw in the 1970s in reality with regards to the major cities, you know, a lot of that's faded. You don't have the crime problems in New York City that you used to have 30 years ago. And also, it just seems that we're so interconnected these days. Everyone's got a smartphone. We've got GPS satellites. Everyone can contact everyone else. It's hard to become isolated, I think, in America today compared to decades past.
What I think is fascinating is that we are seeing a whole host of horror films that I would, for want of a better term, call horror of connectivity, particularly through technology. So the Paranormal Activity films, which I think are pretty interesting, are all films about the assumption of security within your home, the assumption of stability, but in some ways, the very technology that connects us and creates that comfort, the video camera, is also what opens up the door for these really unpleasant things. And then if you look at the examples of films that are kind of borrowed or remade from Japan, where in Ring it's a videotape, in One Missed Call it's the cell phone, the idea that all of this technology that is connecting us is actually opening doorways to really unpleasant things, I think that's a great example of how horror is adapting to this new cultural condition.
I think there's a very bad movie called Fear.com that came out that was sort of this
there is.
Yeah, horror internet sort of combination. I think it was about 5 years ago. But in a film like The Strangers, it came out a couple years ago. Yeah, it seems that the number one task for any sort of horror film that still wants to isolate its victims is to get rid of a cell phone. You know, that's something right. that you've got to do. You know, the remake of Assault on Precinct 13. You know, they had some sort of contraption, I think, to block cell phone calls. It seems kind of crazy that in this day and age that anyone would be able to isolate a police station.
Right.
That would seem to be pretty preposterous. So you've been listening to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I've been talking to Kendall Phillips, who is the author of a new book called Dark Directions, Romero, Craven, Carpenter, and the Modern Horror Film, discussing the iconic horror directors George A. Romero, Wes Craven, and John Carpenter. And thanks so much for joining me this morning, Kendall. I really appreciated having you on.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. Always good to be here.